Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. This episode, we have Liara Tamani, or is it Tamani?
It's Tamani.
Liara Tamani.
Yes, Liara Tamani. Hello, hello.
In Texas. Am I right?
Texas, yes, Houston.
The South.
Yes.
As we call it, as we Northerners call it, the South.
The South.
It's all encompassing all of these territories. Where'd you go? The South?
Nah, H-Town has its own little vibe, though. The South is not just all the South. I feel
it's
like.
It's not. But yeah. Northerners treat it like that.
Yeah.
Like, especially okay. Northeasters, mm-hmm. like myself. Mm-hmm. It's like we say New York, but no, we mean like, New York City.
Right. It's like everybody I remember for a time, it's like you mentioned Texas or you mentioned Houston and they think you're riding around on horses and everybody's like, nah. No, it's not going down like that. I feel like Beyonce did a good job kind of enlightening the general population about Houston a little bit, but no.
I feel as though your Instagrams help us see it in a new light.
Instagrams. Oh, <Lord. laughs>
Where we see it's like, oh, it's a city.
It's a city. Yeah, there are lots of things to do here besides the rodeo. It's a city. You know what it is, though? I will say I've lived in other places. I've lived all over the place. I've lived in New York. I've lived in LA. I've lived in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I will say that Houston, the conservative vibe of it is definitely Southern. It's not one of my favorite things about it. I think I grew up in a really religious household, hence calling my name, my first book. And I had a lot to break free from growing up. And there was like a lot of trauma. And so I like to live very free and I like to be open and I like to be expressive in who I am. And it's not the best place to be like that, I guess. I mean, obviously I have my little circle of friends that I feel safe around, but you hear all types. It's very conservative and there's a lot of people who are watching Fox News every day. You know what I'm saying? I mean, but there's a lot of people who are thinking the same ways and it's still very conservative on the religious front. And so it's not necessarily the freest place I've lived. I feel like California actually is. I love California. It just has a cool laid back vibe that fits me. And I felt very free. There's, you know, one of the places I think kind of found myself. I actually started writing when I moved to California. I wasn't even writing before I moved to California. Actually, I just thought about that. But yeah.
So how long ago was that?
Ooh, do we want to put some dates on it? No, I just have to think about it. I'm 42 now. I went to California like right after law school. Let me see. So I was probably like in my early 20s, 22. And I was out there a couple of years before I started writing. So maybe I started writing at like 24, 25. I'm, you know, just putting that number on it. And when I moved out there, I was just running away from law school. Basically, I was in law school. My father was an attorney growing up. And that's what he always wanted me to do. And I was a people pleaser for a long time. And I'm still trying to break out of that need to feel like I have to please people, especially in my professional life, not necessarily my personal life, but in professionally, I feel like that sometimes. So I was kind of like running towards, I always felt like I needed to be in California or New York to kind of find my kind of creative center. I was looking for creativity. I knew I wanted to create more. And I was like, California has better weather. So that's how I ended up in California.
So then you came to Houston.
That was so I was in California. And from there, I was in New York after that. I was in Michigan. And then I was in San Antonio. And then I was in Houston. So I was a bit everywhere. While in the midst of that, I stayed connected to my writing. When I was in LA, I was taking classes from UCLA Extension. When I was in Michigan and in San Antonio, I was getting my MFA from Vermont College, which you can do remotely. So I was doing that.
And I've had a few guests to the Vermont College.
Yes. Yes.
When.
Yes.
Vermont College of Fine Arts because of that too, the remote.
Yes. I mean, it's like, you know, you married at the time. I was married anyway. And I couldn't be like, all right, peace out. Going to a writing program for 2 years. You know, I couldn't do that.
I mean, you could.
I mean, I could. You know, I could. But I peaced out a lot. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to Africa for a month to volunteer. I was doing my own. I was peacing out, you know, so it was even going to 2 weeks a year. I'm like, okay, bye. You know, I was doing plenty of, okay, bye, but not for 2 years. It'd be hard. You turn it in a marriage into a long distance relationship at that point. And then my ex-husband traveled a lot too. So it would have been like double travel.
No, that is rough though. That is rough. But it's still like this pursuit of what you need to do.
Yes.
And sometimes you don't even realize you need it at the time because you were practicing law, you mentioned.
Yeah, well, not practicing law. I went to law school. I actually left after my first year. I was in law school and I didn't really want to go, but I'd gotten into Harvard. So I was at Harvard Law. There was just a lot of pressure for me to go. And there was a lot of pressure for me to be a lawyer. And, you know, like I said, I had, especially growing up, I was a good girl, as they say. And I want to put that in quotes because I hate the term now, you know, but it's like, that's what I tried to live up to back then. I really wanted to please my parents and please my teachers at the church and do all the things that people thought I should do all the time. And I was kind of afraid not to. I grew up with a lot of fear. And so I was afraid to step out and explore things that felt truer to me instead of, you know, just doing what I was told. And so that's how I ended up there. But when I got there, I was miserable. I was getting to the point where I was like, I can't live my life like this. Like, this is my life and nobody else is living it for me. So I left. I went and worked for a lawyer just for like the summer kind of internship, you know, at a law firm, and they'll pay you the same as they pay the lawyer. So you can rack up a lot of money in a short period of time. So I went just that summer. I did my summer clerkship, I think they call it. And then I took that money and then started fresh. And actually I went to go work for the NBA, the Houston Rockets and Comets, locally where I live. My summers in undergraduate, I had worked for the National Basketball Association because I always thought somehow being a sports attorney or an entertainment attorney, I'd worked for HBO too, thinking that being an entertainment attorney or sports attorney would be more fun or attractive some kind of way. But it's all legal work because you're still dealing with just a lot of paperwork. So that was my first stop after I left law school in Houston, is to work in the marketing department for the Rockets and Comets. And then I ended up saying, no, this is not it either. Like, I really need to find what it is. I needed to do something more creative. And so then I moved to LA and went to art school. All over the place. I went to art school, and it was while I was in art school, and that was like, it was great, but of course it was expensive. And it's like, after all my loans from law school, I was like, okay, you need to start working. So then I started a design business in LA, and I was making custom drapery, custom pillows. I was doing floral design and doing weddings. I was doing all sorts of things in my design business. And while I was working as a designer, I started writing. First of all, I started reading for pleasure. All that time working up, trying to get into law school and then at law school, I was reading only academically for school. I wasn't reading for pleasure. I felt like I had no time for it in order to make the grades that I needed to get. So leaving law school just opened up space for me to actually start reading. And then I connected to really what was a childhood love of writing. Growing up, I loved writing. Well, ever since I read The Bluest Eye, I loved writing. And even throughout my college experience, when I was writing my political science papers or, you know, my history papers, my professors would always complain that what is this? Lyricism. This doesn't belong here. You know, what is this? This is too literary. You know, I always got in trouble for, you know, writing. And even then I didn't know, nothing went off like, ding, 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 you should be a writer. I was too conditioned to be a lawyer that it still didn't go off. But once I was in LA and I had freedom and just time and space, I found one of my first loves. I got back to one of my first loves.
So that's a process. And I remember talking to Abigail Hing Wen also. You know, there's a lot of us, and it's not to say writing isn't work. I'm not saying that. I understand it.
Yeah.
As someone who works in the industry. But there is something instilled in us, the royal we, so to speak, when I say us, of stability.
Oh, yeah.
And does creativity equal stability?
Yeah.
and then the pursuit of stability not always resulting in something that is not necessarily not exciting, because I don't know that everyone's job is exciting, but mm-hmm. something that you're willing to dedicate yourself to.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time. So it seems like this is a pattern that I've seen, especially for POCs, because, you know, podcast is minorities specific, mm-hmm. but also in women especially. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. like, you need to get some stability.
Right. No.
Lock it down. Mm-hmm. Do your whatever on the side. Make mm-hmm. that money.
Make that money. Make that guaranteed money. And that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know I was afraid of moving away from this guaranteed version of success. Oh, I go to Harvard Law School. I get out. I get a job, a high paying job. I will pay down my loans. I will be successful. You know? Yeah, yeah. And then to depart from that and to be like, I don't even know what I want to do. It's like, it's a huge departure. It's a huge risk. And it's a risk that a lot of people aren't willing to take. And it's a risk also, frankly, that it doesn't pan out for everybody, probably. Yes, I made it in a sense, whatever, you know, it's like I have a book published and a book coming out. But for everybody that quits their job and to follow their dreams, you know, it might not pan out. But it's worth the risk, I would think. It's worth going after. And I do believe that if you work hard enough and hard enough, because it didn't happen right away, right? And I felt that because when, you know, I first submitted my, Calling My Name was written in small vignettes and stories. And when I first wrote it, I submitted a lot of the pieces to literary magazines. And it took me submitting over 100 times before my first story got accepted. So you have to hear a lot of no's. I mean, you have to be okay with hearing a lot of no's, and you have to push past hearing so many no's. And a lot of people may take the first 50 no's and be like, this wasn't meant to be. It's not working out. But you got to push past the first 50. Then you might have to push past 50 more. You got to keep on pushing. And it eventually worked out. But I remember doing all of that. And then I have this book at the end and I'm trying to get that out. And when I initially sent that out, I had published problems getting an agent because my character, her age range was too wide for the YA market. And so it took me a while to get an agent. And then I remember just sitting around. I was married, you know, before, but then I had gotten divorced. I moved 3 times. I was working. I started a business and life just had gotten away from me. And then I had gotten back to writing, but then I started writing something new. And then I just thought to myself, wait, you have this book over here that's just sitting around. Before you get into writing this new thing, send this book out again. Something just told me, send this out. And then the second time I sent it out, I got an agent. I had multiple offers from agents within the first round of sending my book out. And then my agent got my deal with Green Willow Books at HarperCollins the first week. So it's like, and I'm saying this only to say that my first book could have still been on my computer rotting away. And then it's a 2-book deal. So my second book was born from the first book, or had opportunity to come to life. I'm like a guaranteed opportunity, I guess, from the first book because of the 2-book deal. So you have to push. You have to push, and you have to push through the nose if you want it to happen. And I guess it's just a matter of time, I think, if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing.
It's so many factors, too, because it is time and it is process and it is understanding your own voice, right? Everyone publishes at their own rate. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, it was very kind of you to mention your age.
Yeah, like, no problems talking about my age.
Not everyone. I'm like, great. You know, transparent. Let's talk about the fact that not everyone's publishing in their 20s. Let's keep that real, too.
Absolutely.
You know, like, this is what you see, the visibility and like the hunger of a younger generation, which is great. And at the same time, it floods the market, right? Mm-hmm. Then that becomes the estimation of this is what I should have been doing. I should have published a book mm-hmm. at 20. I should have published a book 5 mm-hmm. under 35. I should have published a book under 35. Right. I should have published it under 40. And mm-hmm. you know, even people for writing for young people, that trajectory of voice and also focus and not paying attention to what's hot, paying attention mm-hmm. to what you want to write.
Yes.
What you love and who you love and who you love through your stories is so important, I think. I gravitate to people who have a lot more distinction in what they want to say mm-hmm. versus wanting to sell a book.
Right.
And I think that comes through in the writing. And I think that comes through in your writing.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
This isn't a subtweet or like, shame on you. You know what I mean? It's just how I gravitate because I'm also a critical reader and writer. So it takes me time to figure out what I'm trying to say. But my voice is way better than it was 10 years ago or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you can just feel that in the writing, I think. Mm-hmm. And that comes with a level of maturity that may or may not come with age. But it definitely comes with experience.
Yeah, most definitely. I can't write to trends because everything I write, it is deeply personal. Even though it's not my story, it's definitely things that are born out of my own experiences and how those experiences have made me felt. And so with all of my writing, I take the emotions out of those experiences and try to craft a story, a universal story around them. You know, it's a deeply personal process. And honestly, I could not spend time, and I do take time. I'm not one of these writers that can, like, you know, I hear people like, oh yeah, I finished this book in 6 days, or I mean, not 6 days, 12 days or 6 weeks, or I will take us at least a year to write a book. And it's my method too, which for a second I was like, oh, I need to change it. You know, but then now I'm like, no, this is just the way it is. And maybe it changes and maybe it doesn't. But the way I write, it's very hard for me to move on from a paragraph until I like the way it sounds. So I'm not one to just write everything and then go back and revise. I write as I revise. So that also takes me longer. It's a longer process. And so it's a real commitment every day when I show up to the page. I read what I wrote the day before, just trying to not perfect, but get it to sound more and more like I like. And then what I'm writing, I might spend a day on a paragraph. I will do that sometimes. You know, not to say nobody else has a commitment. I'm just talking about my process, but it has to be something that I deeply believe in, because if I didn't deeply believe in what I was writing and what I was doing, I don't think I would do it. But as it stands, I feel like I have to do it. Everything I've written, I feel like I've had to write. Like it wasn't a choice for me. I had to get this out on the page. And so, yeah, you know, it would be nice to be like, oh, I can catch this trend and I can write this book real quick. I feel like it would be probably more, you can make more money, obviously, that way, because you can be more productive and put out more books. And that has its benefits because, you know, the more books you put out, obviously, probably the more recognition you receive and the more you can build your audience. But there are many ways to do this and everybody has to find their own way that works for them. I'm also a little bit of, you know, I have a kid, daughter, and that mom thing will eat up your time, let me tell you. And just trying to be present for her in the hours that I'm with her. You know, I have a very short day writing. I write from when I drop her off. I drop her off pretty much at 8 something. And I have to go pick her up at 3 every day. So that's all I have, those hours. And then every day I work out in that time too. So that's even less time. That's something that keeps me happy and keeps me healthy and that I like to do. I have a short amount of time to do this work. And so that's another reason I'm a little slower, but I'm okay with that. Everybody has their different journeys and everybody has their different paths and everybody has what they want to receive from their different journeys. And I feel okay with mine. I feel good with mine. And that's what's, you know, that's what's most important.
It definitely is. I mean, I have said this before, if not publicly, privately, that I've talked to people who have reached certain levels. And it's usually the people who didn't expect it, who are just like, hey, I'm just here to do the work. Mm-hmm. I just love what I love. I love doing what this is. I love bonding, especially with young readers. It doesn't mean you don't get disappointed, right? But it has a different motivational guidance in how you're going about it, just like you were saying. And you know, I've had people who hit the New York Times bestseller and then are worried about hitting it again and again and again and again and again, or who hit it and didn't know how they're going to pay their rent for the remainder of the year. Ooh. Or hit it 1 week and didn't hit it for 2 weeks, or hit it but didn't earn out. There's all these things, you know, someone who's nominated for this award or no awards, but got a lot of visibility. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so immeasurable that you kind of have to appreciate the form for what it is the opportunity to share the form.
I think
it'll save you from a lot of heartache, but it won't erase it.
No. And it's something I've had to learn. Don't get me wrong. As I was writing my first book, as I first started out writing, it was about the craft and it was about the love of words and it was about the love of language for me. But, you know, when I got into the business and I got on social media and things start changing real quick. You see people who are coming out around the same time as you're coming out and you see other people's success and people you say, oh, I'm cheering for everybody. Yes. But in the beginning too, when you're also new to it and you're taking it all in, you're also seeing what other people are doing. You're like, oh, I'm not at this conference. I'm not at that conference. Oh, my book isn't doing this. And I was overwhelmed by it all. I was working, trying to do whatever I could for myself to help promote myself, which was exhausting. I was like on social media all the time, which social media is really not my thing. It's like, I don't feel like I come across really as myself. And maybe if I spent more time with it, I would. But since I do have a limited amount of time, I don't want to spend my time getting good at social media. So I resent what it takes away from me, just the hours or the time that it takes away from me. My daughter definitely doesn't like me. She doesn't like me being on my phone. She wants me to be present to her. And also, I think there's a tendency on social media for everybody to think the same. And so it just sounds, when I'm on there a lot, it just starts sounding the same. It's like people talking about the same things and people thinking the same. And I found myself when I was on there a lot too. It's like, obviously, if you're on something a lot and you're seeing and you're taking in and everybody's absorbing the same things, it's hard to not be influenced by that. And you see what gets likes. You see what, and so in order to get likes, you're going to eventually, if you're on that platform, you're going to do what it takes to get likes, if you care about getting likes, you know, I didn't like that influence. I don't want to be influenced by trying to do what other people like or what other people expect or what other people think is good. I've had to work really hard for my freedom in my life. Like I said, I grew up not feeling free and it has been a journey to get free and to feel free. And so it is something that I'm very protective of. And so with that social media element, I feel my freedom being encroached on, my freedom of thought. And I feel like it could affect me as an artist and definitely affects me as a human being. It definitely affects my mental health. My goodness, when I was on there all the time during my debut book, I ended up going to the ER. I went to a heart specialist. I went to get my brain checked out. I went to so many doctors. I thought something was seriously wrong with me. And what it ended up being was just panic attacks and anxiety, but I had never really experienced it. And it's crazy because I have lived through a lot of different challenges and changes, and I've been challenged in a lot of different ways, but social media brings, for me, it brought a whole new level of anxiety. And for my second book, like, even though I know I'm supposed to be on there all the time and I'm supposed to be promoting and I'm supposed to be, I had to step away just for my own mental health. And because I want to protect myself in that way, and I want to protect my mind in a way, like I want to make sure that I'm creating from the freest place possible and I want to be free in this industry. So I don't know, it scares me a little bit. And I'm like, for my next book, I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be on there at all. And so it scares me to think, can you have a career without being on social media? Because it is so much about relationships and, you know, but two on there, I don't know, with the relationships I have on there, they don't seem real. I would do a whole bunch better just talking to somebody in person and being like, what's up? Or, you know, me and you, even before we started recording, it's like, what's up, what's up, what's up? I do a lot better just talking to somebody one-on-one. I'm not really good at social media speak, kind of. It's like a whole lingo and it, I don't know, but let me just say that the connections don't feel deep or like they pass over into real life. So what is it really? You know what I'm saying? But I do understand that then they may not pass over into real life. They can take you places in the industry. And so I would miss out on that. But it's like, my relationships and my life are more important. And when I'm on social media, it also takes away from that. And my sanity is more important. My health is more important. Just me as an artist and becoming, because I'm still becoming. Every day I'm becoming. Me becoming the writer and the artist that I want to be is more important than all of that. So I guess the chips are going to have to fall where they fall, but it's about to be what it is.
That's so interesting, because I think that's a part of a larger conversation that doesn't necessarily happen. Or if it does, it happens behind closed doors because the people aren't on social media.
Right. I'm like halfway on there. I'm like kind of on there, kind of, you know. But
yeah, and there's certain mediums that are better for people. You know, Twitter is kind of my preferred medium because I can actually have a conversation with people, even though it's very truncated. However, it is very time consuming.
Yes. And
I've realized as someone who grew up, I mean, as we get older, social media, digital age is going to take up more of our lives than it doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's really 2010s that it kind of became so part of the norm. And the early 2000s, it was still kind of getting its footing. I just remember that time and I was very productive during that time. Yeah. It's not that I didn't sit and watch cable. I would watch cable for hours sometimes, binge on marathon shows. But it was a kind of a tactical thing. Like, I know where my 4 hours went. I was watching reruns of Living Single.
And that's where that went. No, exactly. And I feel like you didn't do it as much during the day. The social media takes up your daily time.
Huge amounts of time.
Huge amounts. No, and then even like 15 minutes here, 30 minutes there, 15. Absolutely. And then at the end of the day, how much time you spent on social media during the day? It's one thing to be like in the evenings, just, you know what? I'm about to chill out and watch some TV. You know what I'm saying? It's a different thing. And then you feel like it's a part of your work because it is a lot. Well, not a part of your writing work, but a part of the marketing work. Absolutely. And so, you know, and I know a lot of people are on there and a lot of people enjoy it. And like I said, I'm 42, so I'm older. I didn't grow up with it. It is relatively new to me, but people who did grow up with it more, the younger people, it's probably a lot more natural to them. Maybe it doesn't cause them anxiety. Maybe they just feel like it's a natural extension of themselves, a way to self-express. And if that's their experience, good for them. But it's just not my experience with it.
And that's real. And it's funny because you're writing about young people. I noticed that I purposely avoid technology when I write. I purposely, even if it's contemporary, I'm just like, it exists, but I don't want to write about it because what is there to write about it? And then she went through Twitter, blah, blah, blah. But going to like all the things we never knew, which is coming out in June, social media plays a big part.
A big part of it, yeah.
To get close to Carly. So this is a love story, accurate.
Yes.
Have you heard a lot of the comparison to Love and Basketball? Has that been kind of like,
oh my gosh, yes.
comparison of like, this is like Love and Basketball for teens.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that is, and I smile when I hear that comparison because I love that movie. It was just in an era too with so many love movies featuring African-American characters, and they nourished me. Growing up, those love stories nourished me. I didn't read a ton of on my own in high school. And like I was saying, in college, it was mostly just academic. But so I got my love stories through those movies. And so they were a beautiful part of seeing beautiful images of Black people doing all sorts of things, all the way from Coming to America to what else was in there? It was a string of movies. Obviously, Love Jones.
The Best Man.
The Best Man. And
what
then
was the one with Tay Diggs?
Yeah.
I forget the name of it.
It was like Hip. It's like
it was something around hip because she was a writer.
Because she was a writer for like Vibe, I think.
Yeah, Erykah Badu's song "Love of My Life" was.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting the name, but I really like that movie.
Yes, that was so good.
Yeah,
that was so good. So in Love and Basketball, I saw that actually when I was in law school, and I remember Monica, the main female character of the movie. She was just so strong. She was so fierce. And she had a huge influence in my life during that time. So these love stories are powerful, and they're not just about love. Just like Love and Basketball just wasn't about love. It was about Monica's journey with herself and going after her dreams and all the things we never knew. You know, it's not just about the love journey of Carly and Rex. It's about their individual journeys And they both have a lot to deal with on their individual journeys. And all of that comes into love. You know, we show up to love with histories. We show up to love with all the stuff going on in our families. We show up to love with all of that. We bring all of that to our relationship, and it affects the relationship. And so this book is about that.
I'm going to paraphrase. Basically, Carly and Rex, they're both basketball players in high school.
Yes.
Seemingly fall in love at first sight. And like you said, they're going through a lot of turmoil, internal, external, all that. And it causes some rifts and challenges and questions that come about of like, what is love? How do we approach it and all these things? And I think it's realistic because there are no easy answers, right? I think the definition of quote unquote love stories becomes happily ever after. Mm-hmm. And we need to leave, I think, readers in general, younger, older, whatever, something like, you know, it happily ever after has its own definitions too, right? So who knows? I'm not going to spoil it in that regard. But it alternates between their perspectives. So we hear from Rex and we hear from Carly directly. And you're talking about kind of where it comes from and liking those kind of comparisons to Black love films. And that's been something I think we've been missing.
Oh, goodness,
yes. In general, we've been missing, like, Black love stories in general. Black-on-Black love stories. No offense to mixed race, and that's fine, all that good stuff. But Black-on-Black.
Yes.
Healthy ones, too, I think.
Yeah, those Black love stories that we were just talking about of the late 80s and 90s and early 2000s, it was without the white gaze. That Toni Morrison's, whose words am I using? I mean, they've been floating around, and that's
She's been the one most often quoted, but I'm sure many people have said that.
Yes, and I mean, I know it's like, the word is everywhere nowadays, but that's how it is. And so there was safety in that. We weren't seeing, and I wasn't seeing myself as white people saw us. When you looked at those movies, you saw people who could be my cousin, my auntie, my uncle, you know what I'm saying? My mom, my dad, all these people. And they were shown in such beautiful light because they were shown as kind of, we see ourselves. And that's the beauty of them. But there's a danger. It's like a danger too. It's like, I know it's a Black love story, and it is a love story featuring two Black characters. But I think too often in the publishing industry, it's like there are two Black characters on the front. So you see they're Black, but then on, you know, whether it's even in Calling My Name, an African-American girl, a Black girl, and these are the facts, but you need to push it for everybody. It's the same with like a girl being on the cover, so it's a girl book. It's there Black people being on the cover, a Black couple, so it's a Black love story for Black kids. No, it's a love story for everybody. White love is not more universal than Black love. Black love is just as universal as love is universal, period. Love is universal. Exactly. I mean, I think that we need to advocate for these books to be sold that way. This is a love story, period, for everybody, not just Black teenagers, because these are human stories with young teens going through all of the emotions that all young teens or a lot of young teens go through. Human emotions and older people too. At every age, I don't know if it ever stopped. Just the journey to be free in yourself, to know yourself. I don't ever know if there's a point where you're like, yep, I know myself all the way up and down. At least that's the way I see it. It's like we are evolving. And not only are we always evolving, we are always in communication with the world around us. We are observing what the world around us is doing. We are reacting to the world around us. And the world around us is also evolving and changing. And so there's a constant change going always. And so in that constant change, it is hard to put your finger on what that is, precise exact thing that is inside of you. But I do feel like the closer we can get to it and the more that we can allow it to lead us and guide us, the better we are off in life. Instead of letting all the external things, you can easily be swept away with social media or all the things going on in the world or what your friends have to say or what, but to let that kind of be your guide. And that's a universal thing. And that's Carly's journey and all the things we never knew. Rex's journey, he has to deal with a lot of pain, with him being an only child, his mother dying, giving birth to him, his father not really speaking to him. And it's a lot of pain that has been suppressed. And a lot of people like to suppress pain. We don't like to feel it. But if you suppress it and suppress it and suppress it, it's going to end up wrecking some things. It's going to end up coming out and destroying some things you love, whether it's like your relationship or things in your work life, or pain rears its ugly head. So we have to face it in order to get beyond it. And so there's so many things besides love, but the romantic love is there. I feel like it's juicy. It's juicy. It's there. But there's a lot of other things that people can connect to in the book as well.
And vulnerability too, right?
Oh yeah, and vulnerability. Rex is so ready for Carly. He's so tender, and I love that about him. Read about more tender boys, but he's so ready and he's so open and he's so vulnerable. And Carly's a little bit more guarded, but you have that in life, right? It's like some people, for whatever reason, can walk through life, have a little bit more of a guard, have a bit more of a shield to their feelings. But it takes getting beyond that, you know, really to really love somebody. It takes an opening. It takes being vulnerable. It takes being soft. Not to say that you don't stand up for yourself. You know what I'm saying? It's like you can have an open heart at the same time that you can have a strong back. And it doesn't mean that you take a whole bunch of stuff off of somebody, you know, but it means that you could be open to the possibilities in the beginning. Now, if they start acting up, you know, you know, that you can adjust and you could decide, and you could decide who's in your life and how much they are in your life and how open you are to them. I know I've had to make those decisions with all types of people, not only relationships, but friendships that I've had a lifetime or a really long time. And if I don't feel safe, it's just kind of like you learn where to put people. I can still know you and I can still go to your child's thing or you, but am I going to open up and divulge everything? No, I'm not, because I've learned I can't be that way with you. But there's so much beauty in the relationships that we can be vulnerable in, so much that can be shared, so much that can be touched. We all have tender places inside of us. We all have things that we kind of keep to ourselves and hold to ourselves. But when we can let other people see and share, I think that it's healing. Like, love is healing. Love is uplifting. It's transcendent. So it's a good thing when we can be like that with people.
Well, if that doesn't sell the book, I don't know what will. As of this recording, we need those healing vibes.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah, we do.
Big time. Big time.
Big time.
Yeah. So the book is called All the Things We Never Knew, and it comes out June 9th.
Yes, it does.
Yay. So do you have any more info on people who can not only get in touch with you about this book, but in terms of your first book, Calling My Name, and just like, are you going to be doing virtual sessions or maybe some stuff later in the summer?
Yeah, that is all coming together right now. Obviously, we had no idea what,
none of us did.
No, like, all of a sudden the coronavirus is like, oh wait, everything is canceled. No more TLA, no more AWP, no more all the things that you had planned. Cancel.
Were you going to go to Book Expo?
I wasn't going to go to Book Expo. I had a little tour planned in June. I mean, with the way things are going, I'm not super hopeful about it, but I am grateful for opportunities like this, you know. So if you're listening and you have a podcast and you want me to be on there, hey, reach out. I'm grateful for opportunities like this. I'm grateful for any opportunity just to not only share and talk about my work, but, you know, just talk about writing. And it's an escape right now. And we need our little escapes from all that's going on in the world. But yeah, people can reach me. I mean, you can reach out through Twitter or Instagram, but I feel like the best way really to reach me is through my website. It's just Leah Atamani. com, and I have a little info form on there and fill it out. I'm really responsive. Teens, kids, I always try to write back because it feels, I know it thought probably feels special getting the letter back. I always try to write back and talk to them and talk to whoever reach out for business purposes, whatever. I'm responsive. So you can hit me up there.
So thank you again, Liara, for being on. And for new and returning listeners, as mentioned, you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or minoritiesinpub. Thank you so much again. And again, the book is All the Things We Never Knew, out June 9th.